Welcome to you this morning. Special welcome if maybe you only come to a church on Easter, or maybe you're new to this building and this is your first time. Special welcome to you. We're thankful that you're here gathering with us as we celebrate the resurrected Jesus. My name is Keith. I'm one of the pastors here, and I'm just delighted that you've chosen to join us this morning. Luke 24. Ben just read these words. I'll read them again. Starting in verse 1. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He is risen. Remember how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee, the Son of Man must be delivered over the hands of sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again." Then they remembered his words. Could that really happen? I mean, did Jesus actually raise from the dead? I mean, people don't just raise from the dead. Sure, the stories that we have in our Gospels are considered credible historical documents because they were written early in the first century, close to the time that these things took place, by people who had experienced them or knew people who did. Sure, they're credible documents, but this story about the resurrection, surely there must be some other explanation for what happened that day. I mean, Jesus didn't just raise from the dead, did he? The women were the first to come to the tomb that first Easter morning. They came early in the morning with their spices to prepare the body. And as they came to the graveside, they saw the stone rolled away. And as they peered into the darkness of that tomb, they found it empty. And their first thought, the first thought on their mind would not have been, "He is risen from the dead." No, their first thought would have been like yours or mine. Where's his body? Has someone taken his body? Is someone playing a trick on us? Maybe they were thinking, hey, maybe we've come to the wrong tomb. Maybe we've got the wrong place. See, there are some in our world that look at the stories in the Gospels about the resurrection of Jesus, and they say that they're made-up stories, they're fake stories, they're fabricated stories. That what they really are a reflection of a first-century worldview that is wrapped up in superstition. That this is a pre-modern worldview, and that if these events were to happen today, we wouldn't come to the same conclusion that the first century people did, because they were prone to believe that people would just raise from the dead. That they had a worldview of superstition, that it was pre-modern, and they were inclined to think that these things happened. That some say this is where we get these stories. This morning, I hope to convince you that nothing could be further from the truth. This morning, I hope to convince you that the response, the reaction of the first believers in Jesus in the first century, their response would be the same as ours would be today. And I hope to bring you to the same conclusion that they came to. That faced with all the empirical evidence before them, they came to the conclusion that defied all of their instincts. That Jesus, who was thoroughly dead on Friday, was now thoroughly alive on Sunday morning. Ready for this? It was the women who were the first to come to the tomb. And in Luke's gospel, he tells us about their response. In verse 4 of our text this morning, he says that they began to wonder about all of this. Their first response was one of wondering. They were confused about what was going on. In Mark's gospel, he tells us that as they come to the empty tomb and as they experience all that unfolds before them, Mark tells us that they are trembling and bewildered. They're in shock. John's account, he tells us about Mary, who's in front of the tomb, and she's weeping, she's crying, and she speaks to somebody whom she thinks is the gardener and says, "Where have you taken his body? Just tell me where his body is so I can bring him back." It's a scene of deep grief. How did the first century people respond to the empty tomb and all that unfolded? They responded the same way that we would. They were confused. They were wondering what was going on. They were deep in their own grief, because the one whom they thought was the Messiah, the one in whom they placed all of their hopes, was now dead. And now this wouldn't necessarily have been anything new for the people of Israel. You see, there were some who had come before Jesus who claimed the same things that Jesus claimed. That there were some who had come before Jesus who had claimed to be the King of the Jews, who had claimed to be the Messiah, God's anointed one, the long-awaited King who would come and establish God's kingdom of peace on earth and to fix everything that was wrong in God's world and in God's people. Maybe you didn't know that. That there were some who had come before Jesus claiming the same things, to be the Messiah who would establish his kingdom and set God's world right again. Let me name three. Some 10 generations before Jesus was a man called Judas Maccabeus, and he came claiming to be the Messiah, to set up God's kingdom and to restore God's world to God's good order. That's what he came claiming. And then some 5 generations before Jesus was a man called Simon Bar Kosaba. Same thing. And then merely 2 to 3 generations before Jesus was a man called Simon Bar Giora. All would-be messiahs claiming that they came to usher in God's kingdom on earth and to set God's world right again. But here's the point. Judas Maccabeus, Simon Bar Kosaba, and Simon Bar Giora, they all died and they stayed dead. No talk of resurrection. Their death simply marked their failure. And so when Jesus died on the cross on Good Friday, as he became thoroughly dead in that day, it marked yet another failed Messiah for his believers. Another man who came along promising everything but couldn't deliver on any of it. How did the first century people respond? They responded like we would. They believed that their Savior was dead, and that was it. His redemptive program, his message, it was all over the day that he died for them. Whatever was unfolding before them that day, they wouldn't have thought it was the resurrection. In fact, their first century worldview would have suggested the exact opposite. It would have pointed them in the opposite direction. You see, first century Jews, they believed in something called a resurrection, but what was unfolding before their eyes that day was so unlike what they thought resurrection was, that they never would have come to that conclusion. For a first century Jewish person, they believed that God was moving human history to a cataclysmic point at the end of time, where someday in the future, where at the end of all things, God would raise up all the faithful from the dead, and at that exact moment, he would eradicate from the world all sickness, death, pain, decay, and brokenness. Tim Keller makes the point well in his book, The Reason for God. He says this. He says, "The idea of an individual being resurrected in the middle of history, while the rest of the world continued on, burdened by sickness, decay, and death, was inconceivable. If someone had said to any first century Jew, 'So-and-so has been resurrected from the dead,' the response would be, 'Are you crazy? How could that be? Has disease and death ended? Is true justice established in the world? Has the wolf laid down with the lamb?' Ridiculous." The story of the resurrection doesn't come from a first century worldview that's prone to superstition and thinking people raised from the dead. No, their worldview pointed in the opposite direction. And no Greek or Roman thinker would believe in the resurrection either, that this is what happened. Because for a Greek thinker, a Roman thinker, the idea was that the soul lived in a body that was prone to decay, and upon death, the soul leaves the body. It's released from its cage, and the thought of it returning to a body would just be absolutely ridiculous to a Greek or Roman thinker. No, no. The idea of the resurrection didn't come from within this first century mentality of skepticism, of superstition, believing that people rose from the dead. And so given all this, why? And this is the important question. Why did the people in the first century, why did those first believers of Jesus come to believe what defies all of our instincts, that Jesus, who was thoroughly dead on Friday, was now thoroughly alive on Sunday? And they didn't just believe this. They believed it with such fervor. They believed it so adamantly that it virtually changed the world overnight. That virtually overnight, there were hundreds upon hundreds of people who believed in the resurrected Jesus in and around the city of Jerusalem. That they believed in the resurrection of Jesus so fervently that it began to change virtually overnight deeply entrenched religious beliefs and practices that were thousands of years old, virtually overnight changed. For instance, the Sabbath. The Jews, they took a day apart to worship God in a special way on the last day of the week, the Sabbath. But virtually overnight, the believers in Jesus who believe he rose from the dead changed their day of Sabbath from Sunday, the last day of the week, to Monday, the first day of the week, to coincide with the day that Jesus rose from the dead. Radical change, virtually overnight. And not just that. That these first Jewish believers in Jesus, they began to worship Jesus as Lord. They began to worship him as God. And within their previous system of belief, that would be such a heresy. That would be a violation so violent that it was punishable by death. What would cause these people to believe in the risen Jesus to the point where they would risk their lives? And not just risk their lives, but lose them. See, virtually every apostle, every early church leader, they lost their life defending the resurrection of Jesus. That they went to their grave proclaiming that Jesus was crucified, died, and was buried, and on the third day he rose again. It was Blaise Pascal who put it aptly for me. He says, "I believe witnesses who get their throats cut." Yeah, I'll say. So why did they come to believe, though their worldview would say otherwise, why, oh why, did they come to believe that Jesus actually rose from the dead? Two reasons. First, the grave was empty. And second, they had a personal encounter with the risen Christ. Allow me to comment on both. First, the grave was empty. The initial response was that someone had taken the body, that someone had robbed the grave. And that happened in the first century. There were grave robbers. But the challenge is, the documents that we have, these historical documents, they speak about guards who were placed in front of the tomb to make sure that kind of thing didn't happen. And so some then have said, well, the story of the empty grave, this whole story of the resurrection, it's a made-up story. It's a fabricated story. Someone was trying to play a prank, and it took. And boy, what an effect it had. But the problem with that is, if you're trying to invent a story, if you're trying to pull a fast one on somebody about the resurrection of Jesus, you do not choose women to be the first witnesses of the empty tomb and the resurrected Christ. And now this might sound sexist to us in the 21st century, but in the first century, women were little more than property. That a woman actually wasn't allowed to give testimony in court because their eyewitness account didn't account for anything. As an aside, I'm thankful that Jesus came to break that kind of distinction. Yeah. But if you're going to make up a story, you don't choose women to be, in the first century, your primary witnesses to all that unfolds. That would have been an embarrassment. No, if you're making up a story, you choose someone else. And so when we read the Gospels, we're reading something that happened. Because historical documents, they tell the story as it happens, warts and all. N.T. Wright has given a piece, he is a biblical and historical scholar, and he's given a piece of information that's helped me in thinking about the empty tomb. He has taught us that when the heroes of the faith died in and around the first century, their graveside was decorated. It was enshrined. They would venerate the death of their dear martyrs who lost their life for the faith. And that we have evidence of all of shrines in the first century to martyrs and people who were heroes of the faith. This is what they did. It was a place where people could go and honor the death of the one who meant so much to them in their religious system and belief. They're heroes. But given the fact that Jesus left such an impact on the world post the first century, I mean, look, we're here today. Given the fact that he left such an impact, wouldn't you think that there would be a shrine to him, some kind of tomb that people in the first century would have went to worship him if he had died? There's no shred of evidence for any tomb anywhere in the historical documents or in archaeology. Why? Because he rose from the dead. Because the tomb was empty. And now the empty tomb wasn't enough to convince the first century followers that Jesus actually rose from the dead. There was more. And the more was that they saw Jesus face to face, that they had a personal encounter with the risen Jesus. And it's at this point, of course, that the skeptic, even the skeptic inside of me, says, yeah, right, who? Well, I suspect that the Apostle Paul was asked that exact same question. That is, he writes to a group of people living in the city of Corinth. He says this to them, addressing that question. This is in 1 Corinthians 15. Paul begins by talking about something that he received, that he is passing on to others because they are of primary importance. And this is what it is. That Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he then appeared, get this, he then appeared to Cephas. Now the people in Corinth would have known Cephas because he was one of their leaders. That Christ appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time. And underline this part. Most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. And last of all, he appeared also to me. And Jesus didn't just appear to one person or to two people, but he appeared to hundreds of people. And Paul appeals to them and says, if you want more evidence, if you need more, and you likely do, because believing in this kind of thing isn't just happen like that, you need to go talk to these people. And some of them are still alive. And the skeptic begins to say, well, yeah, maybe they were just having some kind of hallucination. I mean, doesn't that happen? When someone loses someone they love so dearly, they think they see them out in public. When they're out, they think they see glimpses of them. Things like that happen, don't they? And to the skeptic, I'd say, wow, man, that must have been some pretty strong Kool-Aid to fool not just one person or two people, but hundreds of people in multiple locations. And not just that. The first century Jews, they had words to describe that kind of thing. They had words to describe some kind of thinking we see somebody who has died, but it wasn't the word resurrection. The word resurrection, as I've said, meant something very specific to a first century Jew. And so Paul says, go and ask these people. They saw him. And I suspect that if we could do that, if we could talk to these people, they'd say something like this. They'd say, you know what? I can hardly believe it. But I saw Jesus. I mean, I can't understand it. I can't explain it. But I spoke with him. I saw him with my own eyes. I touched his skin. But it was the empty tomb and an encounter with the risen Jesus that turned the world upside down, and people just like you and I, who would respond just like you and I, came to the conclusion that defies all of our instincts, that the Jesus who was thoroughly dead on Friday was now thoroughly alive on Sunday. And the messengers of God in Luke say, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He is alive. He is risen. He is risen indeed." And this is the good news of Easter. This is the good news of Easter Sunday, that death has been dismantled, that death has been swallowed up in victory, that death does not have the final word, that when we attach ourselves to the living Jesus, then we're raised with him. That is the good news of Easter. That when we attach ourselves to Jesus, death no longer needs to be a cold, hard, dead stop. See, God longs to be with his people forever. But the problem is, sin and death has built this great big wall dividing us from God. And God is unhappy with this situation, this separation. It's not his intent. And so God the Father, he sends God the Son into the darkness of sin. And he rescues us from this eternal separation. And the resurrection of Jesus, as he conquers the grave, is like Jesus busting through this brick wall that is death, making a way for us to be with the Father forever. And that death no longer is final for those who find themselves in Jesus. That death now becomes an entryway through which we pass to live eternally with the one who made us. And all of this is made only possible in the one who conquered the grave. The good news of Easter Sunday is that death has been dismantled. That death does not have the final word. Do you know who has the final word? God. That because of the resurrection, God can and will raise all of us up on the last day. And there we will stand before God, and it won't be death that has the final word, but it will be a merciful and just God. And this is good news, because it means that disease does not have the last word. Oh, and that might mean something very specific to some of you who are facing significant disease. It's good news because disaster and tragedy don't have the final word. Death never has the final word. God does. And as we attach ourselves to Jesus, death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your sting? That as we attach ourselves to the one who conquered the grave, we become more than conquerors. We become co-heirs with Christ. That his future is our future. But Easter, the resurrection, isn't just about some final victory over the finality of death, though it is that. It isn't just that. The resurrection of Jesus is the power at God at work in us to raise us up from everything that draws us down into destruction. That the resurrection of Jesus has power in our life today. That in the resurrection of Jesus, a new day has dawned. A new era has begun. A new reality is unfolding where sin and death no longer control our destiny, nor do they control our living here in the present. You see, the old order of things, oh, it's on this side, isn't it? The old order of things, under sin and death, it was marked by things, an old way of living, like greed, selfishness, pride, arrogance, that we lived out old dysfunctional patterns with one another, broken relationships, where we take advantage of other people for our own gain. But the resurrection of Jesus broke the power of the old creation, that the old has gone, and in Jesus, the new has come. And now we are set free with the power of God at work in our midst to live the fullness of life as it was meant to. And it's not marked by the old things. It's marked by the new things that God has set loose in this world because of Jesus. That we now live marked by love and forgiveness, grace, freedom, healing, hope. This is the good news of Easter. That the resurrection of Jesus unleashes a power in our world, a power set loose to do the very things that Jesus said he would do, to remake what was broken, to heal what was diseased, and to restore what was lost. So what is it in your life? Allow me to ask the question. What is it in your life that's broken and needs to be remade by the power of Jesus? What is it in your life that's diseased and needs to be healed by the power of Jesus? What have you lost that needs to be restored in the power of Jesus? This morning, I want to invite you to experience the resurrection power of the living Jesus. And the only way I know how to invite you into that this morning, or the way that we've chosen to do it, is through song. And so I'm going to invite Beck and the worship team to come forward. And consider this your invitation to open yourself to experience the living Jesus in a new and a fresh way. That is the team, as they play, tune your ears and your hearts to the words of this song. Tune your ears and your hearts to the music in this song. May you open up your heart and your life and let the King of Heaven come in. And as you do, may he bring to life everything that has gone dead. May he restore hope where you're facing despair. So come, open yourselves to the living Christ today.